Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us today. Always thankful to you and The Wren for making a space on Sunday mornings for us. Today, we're going to be talking with Executive Director of the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, Tom Chapman. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rick. How are you today?
It's a great day, and I appreciate you being here with us. A lot of people, I'm sure, think of Albemarle and Charlottesville as a place of history, but don't always think about the Historical Society. So that's what I want to talk about today. What you do, where you are, how people can benefit and enjoy what the ACHS provides to our community. So first of all, let's start with some of the basics. I was fascinated to find out how long the society has been around, because it wasn't as long as I thought it might be. Can you get us started with that?
True. Yes. It's been around for 80 years, though you would think in a place such as Albemarle County and that there would be a little bit more of a history there with an actual historical society. But it gained its founding in 1940, and in 2020, we actually celebrated 80 years of being in existence. Prior to that, there were some, local groups that were focused on historical information and research, but nothing really that was formalized. It took shape really through UVA with some professors and librarian there. And they gathered together a group of folks and formed in 1940. It was incorporated in the 1960s. And we have been working within the city with our main building now being the old public library that Paul McIntyre donated to the city of Charlottesville. And we have been in this building since 1994 on the corner of Jefferson and 2nd Streets, 200 2nd Street Northeast. And we're right next door to the Central Library of Jefferson Madison Regional Library. So, it's 80 years is a pretty long time, though. So there's a lot of history there that we've collected and preserved and have interpreted over that time with our flagship scholarship, which is the magazine that we put out every year. We attempt to put out newsletters as much as possible to keep our membership and the local community up on top of what we're doing. The recent experience of COVID has kind of set us back a little bit, but we are looking forward to trying to do a lot more as we can gradually open our doors a little bit.
So you talk about the Historical Society being 80 years old, and then you mention being in the Paul McIntyre building. The building is older than the society, correct?
That is correct, yes. It was built in or completed in 1921. So this upcoming year of 2021 will be the centennial, the 100-year anniversary of not only the building itself, but also the public library system. So it's something that we're looking to partner with Jefferson Madison Regional Library to tell that story, tell that history.
What are the plans for that? I mean, do you have anything lined up that you can share with us, or is that all still being figured out?
It's kind of in the planning concept stage at the moment. I've had some conversations with David Plunkett with the library, and they're looking to work with us, partner with us to put up some exhibits that will be in the Central Library building itself, maybe also out on the grounds around the old courthouse, which is now the library, and then our library, the 100-year-old building. And then we are hoping to do a fairly extensive exhibit within the old public library to not only interpret its use as a library, but to also kind of tell that 100-year history. It's an interesting story in terms of, you know, how Paul McIntyre was involved in that as a very important benefactor to the city of Charlottesville. And there's other stories that we can tell about Paul and get into that. Lorenzo Dickerson has already been working with the regional library to create a film that is going to kind of be a chronological approach to looking at the history of how that library served the community and how that community in some sense has been segregated in the early period and then opened up over time to include the entire community. So it's something that we're hoping that there are opportunities, even online outreach, even if we can't see what COVID will let us do with bringing people into the buildings. But we're going to try our best to do what we can to make some exhibits and put some stuff together.
Again, our guest today is Tom Chapman. He's the executive director from the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. You can go to the webpage at albemarlehistory.com. Look up a lot of the things we're going to talk about today if you want a little more detail, or you join us part of the way through or have to leave early, which is never a good thing, but understood in today's world. So, Tom, let's talk about some of the exhibits. Can you tell us what is coming up or what you're doing now?
Well, what we're doing now is really focusing more on online outreach. I just started in April. So April 1st of this year was my first day on the job. So that was 2 weeks after the board of directors for the Historical Society had decided to shut the doors. So one of the part-time staff people gave me the keys and I walked into an empty building. She said, "It's good to see you again," and I got to go. And that was my introduction. So it's been a challenge trying to get our doors open to be able to provide for the community and membership what we used to do. So online, we're looking at some different programs that are kind of focused on either resource-based. Our president of the Historical Society, Shelley Murphy, is a longtime genealogist, and we've been partnering with JMRL to put her out on online world to help with genealogical questions. We're doing some speakers and also working on another type of program that we had our first one last night called Unregulated Historical Meanderings, or the UMS, which is kind of one of my staff persons picking on me because I tend to use too many UMS when I'm talking. But so that was a good start, and we didn't get those off the ground until really October, just trying to get my feet under me with all the different things that we needed to do here. That kind of leads us maybe back to what we were talking about with the library and the exhibits that we wanted to focus there is really kind of like I repeat that there's a history in the Central Library with Gregory Swanson and when it was a federal courthouse. So he was the first African American to try to apply to UVA to enter the law school. And that's something that the regional library is very interested in interpreting. And that room was actually called the Paul McIntyre room, or still is. And I think they're trying to change it to the Gregory Swanson room. So it's kind of getting into that topic of how we're trying to dive into the history of the people and the places of the county and the city to tell a whole history.
We'll get into that throughout the hour, talk about names and events and where does slavery fall into the discussion and teachings in a Southern-based community. Mm. But you mentioned the recent unregulated historical meanderings. That had with a First Amendment museum CEO. What goes yes. on in a First Amendment museum?
Well, it's a concept museum, which is a relatively new thing in the museum world. And it's the gentleman who's the CEO up there, Christian Coates, is a longtime friend that I've known for many years. I used to work over at James Madison's Montpelier, and we worked there together. And he just recently, this past year, was brought in to be the CEO for that museum to really get it off the ground. And their focus is really trying to, you know, teach the First Amendment, to have the citizens kind of armed with the knowledge, like James Madison as the architect of the Bill of Rights with the First Amendment. You know, he basically believed that, you know, knowledge was power, and arming the citizens of our country with that knowledge enabled us to utilize our government, utilize our democratic principles and carry them forward. So what they're trying to do up there is tied into the Gannett family. That was a longtime Maine publishing family. They are supported very much by the Gannetts, and they're looking to create kind of a center there for the First Amendment rights.
Now, the Gannett family, am I correct that that's the family that certainly did more, but didn't they start USA Today newspaper?
It's not the same one. If you trace their history back, I think you might find connections, you know, going back to the colonial period, but these are actually two separate Gannetts. So this one is primarily focused in Maine.
Okay. So question, you mentioned that that was a virtual gathering, and the Historical Society is not doing, or are you doing anything on the walls where you let people come in and take a look? And are you doing that now, or is everything virtual?
Everything in terms of trying to gather people together is virtual. That's just simply because of social distancing and health protocols. What we do have open at the Historical Society now is our research library. Since early July, we have been able to have the research library open by appointment. Miranda Burnett is our librarian. We share her as a staff person with our partnership with Jefferson Madison Regional Library. And she's actually recently hired too. She was a few months before me. Prior to that was Margaret O'Brien, who for 30 odd years, she was the Historical Society, and she's still very active in the community, though she's recently retired. But I think last time I saw her, she said even in retirement, I think I worked harder than I did before. But so the research library is open. We've had it open mornings, and we're actually looking over the next couple weeks to open it up full. So that'll be Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then Saturday we'll have hours from 10 to 2 o'clock. So that we allow by appointment. So if you can give us a call or an email, and we'll try to be accommodating to allow you in. So we've had a number of the researchers and historians and other folks locally that know what we have or don't know what we have in our library and want to research particular things. So that's been good.
What would I tell me more? Explain that a little more to me. who would want to come to the research library? Is this for people doing academic work? And I mean, at what point does this help me, and how is it useful, and what do you have there?
We have a large collection of in our library, so I believe it's close to 6,000 volumes in our library. We also have a large manuscript collection, historical archives, research files, all of these things collected over the past 80 years. And a lot of the people who come are very interested in genealogy. We also do research for folks, so people call or email us with questions, and if they can't come in, we try to provide them answers that we can from our what we have on site. We also have a very good understanding and a very strong relationship with the other local libraries, such as UVA, JMRL, as I've mentioned, so that if we don't have something, that we can point them in the right direction. Recently, today, we had a gentleman out of New Jersey, or actually this past week, who was doing research on integration in Charlottesville, particularly looking at the school system and sports teams. And then another gentleman who's come in and looked at some of our housing and urban development files that we have in our manuscript collection. So we have a wide assortment of things. And one of my goals moving forward is to try to make that more accessible. As a historical society, I think we've kind of had one foot in history a little bit too long with our focus on trying to be more digital. So that's one goal I have as a new executive director, is to make a lot of our collections and our archives more accessible, that means.
We're talking with Tom Chapman from the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. Tom, you talk about the research library having all these documents, but what are they documents of? Are they diaries? Are they paperwork, court paperwork? Are they, tell me, what am I going to find? What are these actual pieces of paper?
Many of them are collections that have been provided to us over the years. Had an email recently with a lady down near Batesville who said 40 years ago she bought a house and found all these things, and she kind of had them in a box, or had some of them that she framed, and they were maps and deeds and letters and ledgers. And she's like, I think I need to find some place for them. Are you the place? And I responded back, yes, indeed. So it's a combination of many things. We have in the ability to kind of index and archive things with every our library, then research files that are focused on places, people, activities and incidents in the past. So it's a combination of many things. And so it allows our visitor or researcher to really kind of dive into the history and kind of experience that hands-on experience.
All right, so let's take our first break here, because when we come back, I want to get into a phrase that I found while going through the website. Again, albemarlehistory.com. And Tom, it's called History versus Memory. And I want to talk about that in relation to Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society and how that works there. So we'll be right back. Tom Chapman, the ACHS here in our community. And here we are again talking about history in the Charlottesville, Albemarle area. Tom Chapman, executive director in our area at the ACHS. You can go to the website, albemarlehistory.com, find out a lot more than we're talking about today, and check out some of the photos as well. So, Tom, let's explain to people about a guided walking tour. How does that work in the past, and have you altered it to under the current COVID issues?
Yes. We have tried to reduce the number of folks that can and go on those, but also at the same time, being able to do them outside, we can kind of enforce good social distance practices. We ask people to wear masks, of course, and we've had a pretty good response to it. That was one of the first things I wanted to get off the ground, because it would allow us to really kind of continue to interact and do the you know, boots on the ground history that we want to try to do. And was able to bring in another gentleman who's working for us, Sterling Howe. And one of the first tasks I gave him was I wanted to revamp this tour. It's been around for a long time. It's called our Court Square Tour. And there were other things kind of going on up at Court Square a couple months ago that kind of changed some of our focus, namely the removal of the at-ready statue. So we wanted to kind of tackle that and tell that story.
So tell people, not everyone knows the statue by the name of the at-ready statue. Can you rephrase that or explain it with a little more slang to it?
Mm-hmm. Well, the at-ready statue, or as others called it, Johnny Reb, was the cast statue that was placed in front of the Albemarle County Courthouse here on Jefferson Street in 1909. And with the recent community discussions, there's decision to remove the statue. So it's trying to think through, you know, the reasons why. I mean, there, for those who wanted to remove the statue, they see it as a memorial to Confederacy and that glorified slavery, that celebrated white supremacy, and something that probably didn't belong in a public space that is supposed to be focused on, you know, justice for all the community. Some folks who walked through or by that statue immediately looked at that, and it was a symbol that maybe they did not receive the same type of justice as someone else who walked by that. On the other side of it, people are looking at these as memorials and see them as memorials to fallen soldiers, Confederate soldiers who fought and died for a cause. And, well, there's a certain way of thinking about that from a historical standpoint, is that if you look at the history behind these monuments, not only the at-ready or the Johnny Reb, but there's also other monuments, and you get into the difference of why at-ready came down because it's on county property, and we have the Stonewall Jackson and the Robert E. Lee monuments that are located in city property. The county got onto theirs first, and were able to, you know, make some movement there. The history of why these were put up, it was basically they were put up to make a statement in the early 1900s, early 20th century. And that statement was in the belief in a lost cause, in that after the Civil War and after Reconstruction, Southern communities wanted to restate their, you know, dominant narrative and reshape history in terms of how they told that history. So it's looking at it from the perspective of history is the facts of what we can pull from the past. And if you look at the speeches and you look at the Ku Klux Klan rallies and the parades that took place when these monuments were going up, you can really see, you know, what the thought process was. And now in our present, with particularly these statues, these monuments that are in public spaces, do we really still feel that is something that we want in our community? And that's the historical society is really looking at it from the perspective of the history, and that the monument itself is telling a story. And that story to a large part of our community is not a story that they like or want to see in a public space. But at the same time, removing the statues is not removing history. It's really our community in our day and age making a decision about what we want to look at from the historical past and how we want to shape what our future looks like.
The phrase history versus memory makes it onto the website at least once, if not twice. And I was curious to read about that. Can you explain the difference in terms of the historical society?
Yeah, I mean, history is, the difference is that history is something that really cannot be changed or erased. I mean, these are documents, these are speeches, these are photographs, these are collections, these are the things that we can look at, and we can pull from that information to tell a story. Now, how that collective memory is put together is either versed, you can look at it as history, or you look at it as heritage, or heritage or memory. And there's a certain amount of picking and choosing. You know, each new generation looks at it in one way or another in terms of reprioritizing which parts of that history and which perspectives are the most important and are most relevant. And to say that these monuments are memorializing soldiers is one thing that is hard to jive with when you look at the history of why these monuments were put up. If these monuments, such as the At Ready statue, which was removed to the Shenandoah Valley to be placed in a park there, in a national battlefield park, I mean, there's a context there. There's an importance there that you look at a statue there in a park setting on a battlefield, okay, that's, you can memorialize it. But in a public space in front of a courthouse that is espoused to hold justice and truth, but it's not saying that story to, you know, a large population, particularly the Black population in the city and the county. So how we look at that from our modern perspective is not necessarily changing history. It's simply trying to tell a more holistic and a more inclusive history, and to get beyond where even people in the past, if you look at the Lost Cause, which is basically a mythology that occurred after the Civil War, basically saying that Civil War had nothing to do with slavery, had everything to do with the South fighting for their rights, federal encroachment on those rights, and so on and so forth. When, if you do look at all the different states and as they succeeded from the United States prior to the Civil War, during the beginning stages of the Civil War, they are all stating very clearly, you know, slavery was the major factor in their decision making. So, you know, in some way, shape, or form, we need to get beyond, you know, what, I don't want to say lies, but what misinterpretations of how the history was have been brought up and taught or not taught. And, you know, that gets into where the historical society can really try to tell a whole truth, that there are ways in which the history has been told in the past that were not necessarily right. And that if you include a lot more of the historical fact, you get to a better understanding of it. And to be able to put that out to our community so that, like I said, knowledge is power, and to have an actual conversation about that, as opposed to being as partisan as we are and not being able to listen to what the other has to say, or not being able to listen to even what the history has to say. So memory in that sense is how we shape our views of the past, and it may not be based on history, and it may be based on history. It's a matter of really diving into the nuance there.
Tom Chapman here from Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. Tom, let me ask, if that is the case, are memorials such as the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, the Charlottesville, the new UVA Memorial to Enslaved Laborers, those statues, those memorials, which are seemingly based on history with names or first names only, lack of names, but names that can be found in history, as opposed to statues of singular leadership. Should the statues of singular leadership, almost as a whole, should those come down?
Well, that is a good question in terms of looking at it across many different communities throughout the South and also in the North and in the Midwest. You know, these types of monuments exist throughout the United States and have been put up for many various different reasons. And that's really why, you know, what we're looking at here with these particular statues, these particular monuments, is to say, you know, look at the speeches that were given when they were put up. Look at the newspaper accounts of how, you know, the Ku Klux Klan had a rally and said, you know, all the deplorables in the city, you better just leave because, you know, we're going to be here and we're going to tell you this is ours. I mean, and that's saying something very strongly about why these particular monuments in the city of Charlottesville or on the county land were put up. Now, how that relates in other counties or in other communities, I mean, it's like their local history is very important in that. You know, all these other historical societies or state or city community historical groups can look at each of those and tell that whole story. And I think that's really been happening in many ways across different areas throughout the South as it relates to these particular monuments. And then it comes down to, you know, our democratic principles being practiced. And if there are elected officials, and particularly if these monuments are placed on public land, then there's a certain commitment that these public officials have to providing to the entire community. And if by understanding that a large percentage of that community says, this isn't a park for us, this isn't a statue for us, this represents something that thinks of us as a lesser person. And so how can we continue as a community in thinking of civil rights and thinking of equality? How can we move forward as a community if we continue to think that this statue is actually inclusive when it isn't? Or we make up a story about why it was put up there instead of looking at the history to understand why it was put up there. So, I mean, it's a complex question that you ask. The slave labor monument over at UVA is something that has been long coming in terms of a deeper study of the African-American community, not only in Charlottesville and the county of Albemarle, but as it's related to where I used to work at Montpelier, and bringing in the descendant voice into the conversation of how we interpret a plantation where the slaves, they were considered property, and they're nameless in many ways, and they don't really have a history. You have to really dive deep to even discover that history. And, you know, descendant communities trying to even look at genealogy to understand, you know, where they came from, and they hit that wall of, you know, 1865 because they can't trace their family back because, well, they weren't listed. They were property. They were, you know, 3/5 of a person as the Constitution would have it. They were, you know, listed only with a first name or even not a name. And even then, in those cases, it was for tax purposes. So there's a really strong interest because that really connects these folks and says your history is important, your story is important. And I think it helps us in a modern day community to really think about that because there's a whole story there that has not been told or ignored or purposely segregated and pushed to the side. And I think that is something that we need to look at and with how we've done history in the past and say that's not something we want to continue now or into the future.
I was surprised when looking a little bit into this part of the conversation that Germany today has no monuments to Hitler or the Third Reich, no memorials to Germans who fought in World War II. I found that surprising. I mean, because even today in the U.S., we still have monuments throughout the country to the Civil War, people who disagree with them. And since 1991, monuments to Lenin and Stalin and Russia have been torn down. Are we rewriting history here as well?
Well, rewriting history is, like I said, it's how we look at that documented past.
And, okay, and let me rephrase. Is this re-narrating history for the 2020 viewpoint? And in 2050, people are going to say, why did we tear that down?
It's hard to say what the future holds, but I think in terms of our community and on a local, regional, and national level, particularly with what we've seen, not only with COVID's impact, but with, you know, the certain social upheaval over Black Lives Matter and other movements that have kind of torn through different cities and states and communities throughout the nation, that it's brought into focus something that is that we need to come to grips with as a country. And I think one of the best ways to come to grips with it is to tell a whole history and to get to that truth. Whereas before, there were certain parts of the community that were not even included in history, so to speak, because it was a history of the important movers and shakers. It was the founders. It was the big men. And those were all primarily white individuals, and particularly in Southern society. And one thing, give a little bit away from, you know, our next magazine that's coming out. But in our next magazine, we have a transcription of Paul Gaston and by Charles Moran, who was a past president. And Dr. Gaston was a longtime UVA professor of history, also very active in the civil rights movement here in Charlottesville. And I just want to quote, you know, something that he wrote, or he actually in this transcription, he said, I majored in history in college, and it seemed like a good thing to do would be to teach Southern history and then try to find a job in a major Southern university and teach Southern history to the people who are going to be, and he says, quote, leaders of the South, and sort of hold up a mirror to them and say, look, this is what your society has really been about. Wonderful things to it, but it's a deeply flawed society. Look at it, examine it. Is this what you want to continue? Have it continue to be in the future? So that's a quote from Dr. Gaston from that transcription. And I think it's a very important thing that, you know, as we look at our community, civil rights, you know, going all the way back to slavery, there has been a racial dimension to our history and how we tell our story. And I think moving forward, we need to really think holistically about how we pull all these stories together into a national dialogue. And that can be something that, you know, helps lead us into the future and hopefully gets us to a better place. I mean, historians look to the past. You know, we're not soothsayers and we can't tell you what the future holds, but I feel very strongly that there's examples and things that we can look at in the past that can really help us in our modern day.
Well, I took a couple classes from Professor Gaston, and as someone with a house full of thousands of books, fiction books, I still have a couple of the nonfiction books that I took with his class. Okay, Tom Chapman with us today, Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, where he's the executive director. Let's take our next break and we'll be right back. All right. Thanks, everybody, for sticking with us today. Fascinating conversation with Tom Chapman, Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. You can find them downtown, albemarlehistory.com. Take one of the guided walking tours, and there's certainly plenty more to do. We'll be getting into that in the last part of the show with some of the upcoming events. Tom, we were talking about history versus memory, and that really plays a role right there with your building, I believe. You mentioned that very early in the program. The building originally named for Paul McIntyre and now determined to be someone, a former slave owner, correct? Or someone whose behavior might want to be, have his name taken off the buildings and put someone else's name on there now.
True. No, yeah. Paul McIntyre was not a slave owner, just to make sure that's clear.
Not old enough to be a slave owner.
Not around. No, he was born, I think, about 1860 or 1861. I can't remember exactly. But, yeah, he was very young during the Civil War. He was born in 1860. I was just looking at something here. It's something that we need to look at with Paul McIntyre. You can't go across Charlottesville without seeing something named after him, or if you don't know the history behind certain things, such as he had nothing to do with the At Ready or the Johnny Reb statue, but he was very instrumental in commissioning the Thomas Stonewall Jackson monument that's near the courthouse, the Robert E. Lee monument here in Market Park that is just in front of us in the Historical Society. Also the Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea statue up on in that island right there on Main Street at the end of it. And then also the other Clark monument over there at UVA. And very instrumental as a benefactor and a philanthropist throughout the city. In the late or early 20th century, 1900s through the 1930s, basically looking to, you know, do some good things for his hometown. Worked hard. He did a lot of great things in terms of putting together some wealth and building himself up to be able to do something like that. But you have to look at it, too, from the perspective of, you know, these, particularly the monuments being on public land. But as you pointed out, the Historical Society exists in the old public library. And that's part of the story that we're going to look at with JMRL and saying that, you know, that public library, when you say public in 1921, that was referring to a segregated Jim Crow era, and that was white only. And the public library was technically integrated in 1948, meaning the building that we're in now, but it really didn't come about until the 1960s when the Gordon Avenue branch was created. Prior to that, there was a quote-unquote separate but equal library that was created over at the Jefferson School called the Colored Branch in 1934. But it was unfunded in 1948. Hence, when they said it was unfunded, therefore it was integrated. But that's part of what we're going to hopefully delve into a little bit and with Lorenzo Dickerson and the film he's doing and the other work and trying to understand, you know, some of the people who may still be around who can tell that history. So, yeah, it's a complex story when you look at Paul McIntyre, and it's a matter of trying to determine how to interpret that history. I mean, you can't take away that he did some really wonderful things for this community in terms of parks, in terms of buildings, in terms of philanthropy. But also at the same time, you can look at some of the things of that period that he supported. And, you know, maybe that is not something our community wants to support at this time. So, you know, there's a give and take there in terms of his legacy that I think we need to look at a little bit more.
So the question is, do we throw out the good with the bad?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not going to put Paul McIntyre in the same realm as a Thomas Jefferson, but there's...
Well, that's a great point, because the city council voted to officially remove Jefferson's birthday as a holiday.
That is something that as a democratically elected body that they can determine if they feel that it is something that their constituency supports. So that's one thing in terms of making that decision, but on a historical national, you know, level and how we look at a Thomas Jefferson, we just simply need to understand him as human and realize that there was a means by which he lived at in a period of time that not that we support the fact that slavery existed, but that it did exist. And you can't take that away. And you can't create mythological icons that are not, you know, complex and nuanced, because I think it really takes away from, you know, what we try to understand as our history. If we're constantly mythologizing our past, we never really learn from anything from it. We just kind of, it's more of a rah-rah kind of look at what we did. But all of a sudden, it's like, then you look at the present and say, well, how can we be so messed up at this point? Well, no, it's always been a little bit messed up. It's just, we never focused on that. We never told that story. And particularly when the dominant narrative that has excluded a large percentage of our history, particularly in the Southern focus on slavery and segregation and Jim Crow and all of that, you know, and even looking at equal rights and, you know, when Representative John Lewis passed away recently and looking at his body of work that he had done in his life and thinking, you know, he's thinking even my kids or my grandkids may never see full equality. And I think a large part of it is that is because we have not paid attention to that history, or there has been a dominant force in how that history is shaped. Kind of what Paul Gaston was saying, in that there needs to be a more honest, you know, interrogation of our past so that we can put that hopefully behind us and move forward in a different way. Now, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater in all cases. And there's something with, you know, there's a the gentleman I work with here, Sterling Howell, has a sociology degree. So he always likes to spout off to me about different sociological theories and stuff. And he was talking about Everett Hughes back in the 1940s, and he described what's called master status. So, you know, I can look at you, Rick, and say, you know, you're a radio person, you're a father, a husband, a son, you know, you have different categories and statuses. But then I could find you as a racist. I'm not saying you are. Like, look at Paul McIntyre, we define him as a racist, and that becomes a master status where everything else is ignored. And it takes away from the nuance and the complexity of who this person was. So it's almost flipping it, because when Hughes was doing this back in the 40s, he was saying that when you look at a black person, that if you see them primarily as black, you don't think of them in any other way beyond maybe the stereotype that you have been taught. And it takes it away from who that person actually was and what they've done. And historians have looked at that too, and how they've looked at the past. So flipping it completely on its ear and turning it the other way around and having people who are, you know, I've been trying to, you know, I had a newsletter I put out, and there was a Black Lives Matter sticker that ended up on our Historical Society sign, and I put it front and center on our newsletter. And I received a few comments about that. And they really kind of in some ways took it to an extreme and saying, you know, what are you going to do, burn down Monticello next? I was like, no, all I'm trying to do is to say there's a complexity to the history that we need to really understand, and that we need to make sure that we are telling as many sides and perspectives of that so that we get to, as much as we possibly can, a certain type of truth, even though, you know, there's never a full understood historical truth because it just doesn't exist. So did that get to where you think answering that question?
Well, as a as someone with the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, I think you do a great job of sharing thoughts and helping explain things. Tom Chapman here with us, where he's the executive director at the Historical Society. So, Tom, before we, as the hour is winding down, I want to make sure that we let people know about some of the upcoming events. I've certainly got other questions and things to talk about, but I don't want to lose track of sharing some of the upcoming events here that are ongoing. So if you'll We can talk about these for a while. So one of the ones that caught my eye was this coming Wednesday. There's one called Ask a Genealogist, because you mentioned genealogy back, talked about the collections and the research library. So what's going on there?
Our Ask a Genealogist program is a partnership we have with the Jefferson Madison Regional Library. Miranda Burnett and Dr. Shelley Murphy, who is a genealogist. She also works on the Enslaved Laborers Project at UVA. And we have about an hour, hour and a half program that people can register for. They can go to the JMRL website and register for it. They can submit questions ahead of time. And we're doing that once a month. So this next one is on the 9th of December, a Wednesday at 7 p.m. And she is basically just trying to take these questions and help answer them. So we've had done two of them so far and have had a really good connection to people. And it's really just trying to help people understand their family history. We're also trying to keep a speaker series going. Though it's all virtual and online. Our next one of the speaker series will be on the 15th of December at 7 p.m. That's a Tuesday. And we're going to have Jordy Yeager from the Jefferson School.
Jordy's been on this program, I don't know, half dozen times. Jordy is awesome.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the opportunity. I've been able to meet Jordy, you know, Zoom with Jordy and interact with him that way. I haven't actually met him in person, but I'd love to be able to have that opportunity. He's going to be talking about his Mapping Seville project. So that's something that we're looking at. And then our next program in January, we're going to have Ed Ayers. And January on the 19th will be our annual meeting. So we're hoping to have Ed Ayers kind of talk to a little bit about what I've been talking to now in terms of that whole history, how historical society can be a community civic minded organization that is trying to, you know, push us forward in a certain way that, that gets us to an important place. So we're looking forward to having Ed come and talk to us.
I saw that one of the other things, I don't know if this is past, present, or future, the Historical Society is working on some county historical markers.
Yes, we have been working with Siri Russell with the Office of Equity and Inclusion with the county. And that also involves the county's Historic Preservation Committee. So there is a project in place and to try to put into place county markers. So these are similar to the Virginia State Department of Historic Resource markers, the big silver ones you see on the side of the right-of-ways on public roads. The county is looking to create a program that becomes a little bit more kind of local, regionally focused and can tell some important stories about some figures and individuals and places in the county. So we're partnering with them to help get that off the ground.
All right. So can people go to the website? We've talked several times about the magazine. Can people go to the website to subscribe to the magazine?
A subscription to the magazine is a membership. And yes, you can go to our website and click on support, and under support is membership, and join the Historical Society. You can also give us a call if that's easier for you. You can look on our website to find our number and we'll take your membership that way. And we're always looking to bring in new members and also volunteers. Even though we are technically closed and only open by appointment, we have plenty of work that we're trying to do. Recently, back in June, unfortunately, so it's one thing after another with what I started with, we had a massive water leak in the building. And the city was great It's their building that we lease from them, so they were great in responding to it. But it really brought front and center the concern that we need to have for our collections and the preservation of those collections. Luckily enough, there was not a lot of damage of our archives or our collections, but it definitely opened up some opportunities for us to really kind of dive into a better organization of what we have. So we're actually have a number of volunteers that have been coming in that Sterling Howell, our volunteer and programs coordinator, has been bringing in. And, you know, they can help out on their own time when they feel like it. If they want to help give a tour or if they want to help in the library, that's great. If they don't want to deal with anybody and they just want to, like, you know, stick their head in a banker's box full of documents and help us organize them, we got that project for them too.
Okay, last question, because we're down to less than a minute. I always enjoyed the Spirit Walk. What happened? What's going on with that?
Spirit Walk, with me starting in April and trying to figure out, you know, what the future held with COVID, we just could not make it happen this fall.
And for those who don't know, that's sort of a walk about ghosts and the cemeteries, et cetera, in the downtown area.
Yeah, and the next guided walking tour that we're kind of revamping and getting online is for Maplewood, but we're also looking at trying to bring the Spirit Walk back maybe in this spring, late spring, early summer. So it'll be a little different variety of it, but I think if the weather and the season allows us and COVID and vaccines and all that, we're going to try to get that back because we knew it was a very important event that we put on for the community.
Tom Chapman, Executive Director of the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. Go to the website at albemarlehistory.com. A little more details on where to sign up for these upcoming events and how to do these things. And a lot more than we talked about today. Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope maybe we can invite me back and we can get a little bit deeper into some of those things we didn't talk about.
You know it. Anytime. All right. Thanks, everybody. And next week we'll be talking about drug policy and some of the voting that happened back in November. See you then.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.